I would like to say I'm pleased to be here, but I'm always a bit nervous about being in Oxford, having started out in the other place. But nevertheless, I am pleased to be here in order to talk to you today. This is a compendium piece, I guess, in that it depends very much on the work of others, but the work of others that I've tried to orchestrate a little. And as Moshe said, this goes back really to the work we did on Sartre some 12 or so years ago, where we started looking at this wider benefits issue. And it's something that still is not resolved, and it's something that, again, we've been looking at quite seriously in the case of HS2, trying to advise the HS2 people not to overstate the claims of the benefits, but to make sure that they get them somewhat nearly right. And if there are any people who live in very beautiful parts of the Chilterns here, please don't throw things at me, because it wasn't my idea to go that way. What's this all about? Well, I guess it comes out of that old issue that transport is seen as being a determinant of land use and economic development, the wider economic benefits issue, though we now don't call them wider economic benefits, we call them wider economic impacts, because they can go in both directions, and I think that's probably right. And the problem is that formal appraisal sort of has swung, as these things always do, between we better not include them because there might be double counting, to, well, there must be something out there, so let's add something on. And 10% seems about right, and we can justify it with a little bit of a sleight of hand, that 10% is probably not too much and not too little. But of course, a lot more work has been done over the last 10 to 20 years in trying to improve our understanding of the way that accessibility should affect the performance of firms and should affect the performance of labour markets. But the problem is that the empirical evidence is really rather problematic. The aggregate level, all the problems of endogeneity and causality, but the conflicts that we seem to get between the macro-based estimates and the micro-based estimates, and the whole issue about what are we looking at? What are the interrelationships? What are the spillovers between different areas? And that has been very important because of the sort of competition that exists between different jurisdictions, either to try and grab more transport or, in many cases, to get rid of it. No, we don't want a station here. You can have it. You can have it, you can have all of the noise, but maybe we can get the benefits from it. And that was something that certainly I experienced quite directly during the decisions over the routing and the location of stations on HS1, as it's now called, the Channel Tunnel Rail Link, where different parts of Kent wanted, as it were, not to have the station, and other bits did want it. And so you get that sort of battle. But there are real difficulties here, because if we get it wrong, you might underinvest in transport infrastructure, you get lower growth, you get congestion as a result of that. If you overinvest, you get problems, public budgets, which of course are a particular concern now, and you get that, and those negative externalities associated with overexpansion. Good example of overinvestment is where different cities that are really rather close to each other not only want an airport, but want an international airport. The case that I identified that is actually a German case study. Why should both Leipzig and Dresden, both in the same state indeed, have international airports? Neither has quite the service that they would want, and both of them trying to compete with each other for that. So what I'm going to talk about today is, first of all, this issue of the relationship between transport and local economy, but also to think about what is it we're expecting transport to do. What are the objectives of policy with that? Because I think sometimes we forget what it is that we're trying to do. Obviously, at the centre of this is the agglomeration issue. What is the science behind that? And where can we find evidence from three different levels of looking at this? At the macro level, what's sometimes called the meso level, what I tend to call the market studies, and importantly, increasingly important, I think, the micro studies. But what I really want to do then is to conclude with what I think the implications for appraisal of these things are and what the implications, therefore, for policy are. Well, we go back to this, the multiple nature of transport. All good transport economics textbooks, and have to be the author of a very good one, the good bits, of course, having been written by my co-author, start with this idea that transport's a derived demand. Well, yes, we know it is, and there's the old stories about, you know, how nobody travels for its own sake. That's probably not true anymore. But of course, the other idea is very much coming from the other aspect. Transport is also a substitutable input. As transport is improved, as transport has become relatively more efficient and relatively cheaper, then people clearly do substitute transport for other sorts of activities, particularly for expensive land. You can see that in the way that the supermarkets have developed as a result of the growth of the motorway network, for example. You can see it in all sorts of different ways. And therefore, in that sense, transport can be regarded as an engine of growth. The danger is that we start thinking that whenever we improve transport, it will always be an engine of growth. And therefore, all we need to do is to put transport in. And of course, there is a sort of old-fashioned Keynesian argument that would say, well, of course it is. Big infrastructure is a good thing to do. What was it that Barack Obama said in his State of the Union address? He was going to bring 80% of the US population within reach of high-speed rail. I was actually in Washington at the time. I was listening to this. I think, what does he mean within reach? Is this an American reach that, you know, you can drive to it within, you know, 12 hours or something like that? And where are these 80% of the population? He's just putting one up the East Coast, one in Florida and one in California. Does that bring 80% of the population? What does he mean? But, you know, clearly infrastructure is being used in that sort of way. And it does do that. And we mustn't forget that important element of infrastructure, but I think we're looking for something more than that, for how it kickstarts other aspects of the economy. Of course, that then brings us back to the more traditional scientific arguments about the role of accessibility in this. But accessibility works in two different ways. The traditional way is looking, you divide the world up into, you know, either quite large areas or, with any luck, into quite small areas, and you're looking at the accessibility of those areas to somewhere else. And that was one of the things that we particularly got concerned about in the SACTRA review all that time ago, which was there called the two-way road effect, but this is the centre-periphery argument. If you improve the accessibility of peripheral areas to the centre, it doesn't necessarily benefit economic activity in the peripheral areas. So that what you might do is just simply use that as a way of, if you like, sucking economic activity in to those areas that have already got benefits. But I think there is also the other argument about accessibility, which is the internal accessibility within those areas. And that can have two different effects as well. It can have the effect, on the one hand, of improving the efficiency with which the local economy is organised. You improve the labour market in that area by developing a local transport that gives access to this high-level infrastructure. And that is important. But we can also see the effect that that has, that if you do that, what you might be doing is actually causing centralisation within areas which might also be peripheral. So if you look, for example, at the impact of the European Union's Trans-European Networks programme, it's not necessarily bringing huge benefits to the most peripheral areas of the country, but it might be encouraging concentration of activities from the poorer areas of poorer countries into their more advanced areas. So, you know, if we think about a country like Portugal, for example, the improvement of links to Portugal may well be quite beneficial to Lisbon in terms of bringing it into the sort of the core area of the European economy. At at the expense of, not of Madrid or of Paris or of Frankfurt, but at the expense of other regions in Portugal. And that has all sorts of effects. And in fact, tomorrow I'm back in Brussels, and we're talking about the problems that exist for those regions that lie between the major centres on the high-speed rail network. So the fact that you don't get as much benefit spilling out to places like Ashford or Calais from the high-speed rail network. So, little bit of local pleading on my part here, given that I've only got one train a day each way between Ashford and Brussels. But nevertheless, there are problems about spreading these benefits to the areas through which the infrastructure runs. In terms of that, therefore, we're thinking about the role that accessibility plays in terms of economic efficiency, but we're also talking about how far the user benefits that users derive from this get benefits from this, and whether that can be counted as wider benefits. But then we come to this important policy area. Is, in fact, transport not overburdened? It's a solution to all of our problems. It might be a sort of, in some senses, a sort of bread and circuses argument, you know, give them better transport and they won't complain as much about the world. And therefore, transport issues tend to get subordinated to wider policy interests. And that over-reliance on transport to solve all a region's problems or a nation's problem might sometimes be unwise. Telling the American people that 80% of them are going to be within reach of high-speed rail might be a clever way of deflecting them from all of the other problems of the economy. Actually bringing, I don't know if it's 80%, but a very high percentage of the China's population within reach of high-speed rail, whether that is going to help the Chinese economy or whether it's going to increase the problems that are faced by the Communist Party of China's ability to keep control over the Chinese economy. Now, I'm not going there tonight, but it's an interesting question nevertheless. If there are wider benefits in this and appraisal techniques are ignoring them, then we may well be getting the wrong level of investment, and therefore we need to understand better what the complex impacts that transport has on output and growth. How does it make industries more competitive? How does it lead to productivity growth? How does it lead to the change in the location of activities? And what does it do for employment? And I think we need to understand those sorts of issues. Now, we know much more. Over the last 20 years, we've started to understand what the new economic geography tells us. I'm not going down the road of saying whether it's new or whether it's geography or whether it's economics in terms of that. But the structure of that does tell us about the necessary linkages we've got. The way that transport costs are a determinant of the price of an urban location, and in particular, and I think the really important thing that approach, you know, following Paul Krugman and the developments of it from there, have told us that what is really important in this is the real wage. It's about the way in which changing transport doesn't only change the labour market in that it changes the attractiveness of different locations, but it changes the price of all activities that exist at that location. And therefore, it can give you continuing agglomeration before you start running against the disbenefits, because the cost of living at those locations may well fall. Things are very much cheaper in those urban locations than they are in more rural locations. So it's helping us to go beyond. It's not just looking at that simple value of time savings as the primary transport benefit. It is the primary transport benefit, but things will go beyond that as well. So we get the increasing returns to scale. We get the effects on market size. We get the effects particularly on linkages that give us that cumulative causation. But then the question always comes back at some stage of this. So are you always going to get agglomeration? Is it universal? Is it inevitable? I think the good answer to that is no. And that's a good answer because it's very good for people who do research on this, because it means that you can't say we've solved the problem, we know what the answer is. The answer is going to be different in all sorts of different circumstances. You've got to understand how a local economy works to be able to know what the impact of any change on the transport provision of that economy is going to be. You cannot simply transpose the results you get from one set of analysis to another particular set of circumstances. And I always like, you know, that's if I'm talking to academics, it's always we need more research. If I'm talking to politicians, it's always we need more research. And so that's always a good answer, I think, to come out with in both of those cases. Now, what about labour market impact? It's about the integration of labour markets. And that comes through three channels, if you like. One is about changing participation rates. If you open up opportunities to areas where there are low participation rates, then more people can participate in the labour market. You might get increased working hours. We've tended to ignore the increased working hours. Now, you don't get increased working hours, but you might get increased working hours. The way I've tended to explain this to students in the past is to say that if you arrive fresh at work, you don't spend the first half hour like one of my colleagues does, having three cups of coffee and then going outside for two cigarettes. You get down to work straight away because you've arrived fresh at work. So you do get increased working hours out of people like that without changing their nominal working hours. But the most important, and those first two things have often been disregarded rather because we're not quite sure how well we can measure those things. But the move to more productive jobs, increasing employment density, does seem to have positive impacts on productivity and on wage differentials. But again, no, beware of the dangers. Don't simply transfer parameters between modes. Don't simply transfer them between cities. And increasingly, because this is what we've been looking at, trying to try and get a handle on with HS2, if we get sort of reasonable results for individual city regions, can we also transpose those to intercity connections? Or is that an entirely different ballgame? I was very pleased that I got an email from Tony Venables telling me he couldn't come tonight because I did tell him that I'd stolen his diagram and modified it. But I think this is the best way of looking at this, which is due to the work that Tony did, which very much was work that we commissioned from SACTRA for him to give us a theoretical basis for where the agglomeration benefits will be. And what it says basically is that in a city you get a markup on the wage at the city centre. The city will be so big because this is the cost of transport. And then it's quite simple. What happens is you reduce the cost of transport, the labour market will get bigger, the city gets bigger, and you will get a benefit both to the existing commuters, if you like, because they've got cheaper commuting given by Alpha, and you'll get this additional net benefit of Beta as the labour market increases. But if there are agglomeration economies, then what we're saying is as the city gets bigger, the potential benefits, the wage markup at the city centre, grows with the size of the labour market, and so that it's called in this the wage gap will get bigger. And if you get that, the city will get even bigger. And not only is there then this additional increase in the size of the city, but you will get an additional markup at the centre for those people who are already working in the centre. It's not just the reduction in the transport cost, the alpha to them, is that delta element, which is that increase of benefits, which is about the increase in productivity that derives from the fact that they are now working more productively in the centre. And I think that that's a neat theoretical way of demonstrating what it is that we're talking about. The question then is, how do we go out and capture that? Well, in the aggregate, we can capture the fact that there is a relationship between accessibility at the NUTS 2 level, which is what's being measured here, and GDP per capita. This is based on a forthcoming paper in a handbook of transport economics that Emil and I, with two other people, have been editing for what seems like too long, but it is, we are assured, coming out later this year. Well, Michael Wegner has just taken there, and you can see that very clearly there is a sort of relationship between accessibility measured against some sort of standard for the EU and GDP per capita. But you clearly get outliers from that. You can quite clearly see the way that the big cities, the London, the Munichs, the Frankfurts and the Parises, are outside that. You can see how Norway, which doesn't have very good accessibility, but it does have oil and fish, is outside that. You can see the way that Eastern European countries, which don't have particularly good accessibility, are well below the line. So it shows that in some aggregate sort of way, there is a relationship between accessibility and GDP per capita, very crude measures of what's going on. Okay. So where do we get this evidence from? We can do numerical simulations, we can give theoretical explanations, but we actually require, if we're going to apply this, real evidence based on real data. What's the geographical scale that we should take? If you're building a high-speed railway line between London and Birmingham, to take a current example, over what scale do you look at the impacts? Do you look at the impacts just in London and Birmingham? Or do you look at them at the other extreme over the whole country? How focused should those geographical areas be? How far can we control other factors which are going on at the same time? Well, there seem to be, as I said at the beginning, three types of study: the macro, the market level, and the behavioural response of individual agents. And I say in advance that I think the most interesting one is really going to be the behavioural responses of individual agents. The macro stuff goes back to the work, unfortunately, of David Ashour. I say unfortunately because I think Ashour probably misled everybody and led them off in the wrong direction, in the sense that by doing things that were gave A, answers that were so optimistic, and B, were based on somewhat dodgy econometrics, he led people to believe in the first case that public infrastructure would always be beneficial, but he also encouraged people to debunk what he was doing at the time. It's my advice to students is always, if you get very, very positive coefficients and an R squared above 0.8, don't tell anybody because they will find a way of proving you wrong. Just looks too good. And that, in a sense, was the problem with Ashour. There were lots of econometric problems, but it led to this industry, vast numbers of papers, which are still coming out, I know by the number I get to referee on that, and which go into also more sophisticated econometric, good, bigger discussions about what we should be measuring. Is it output? Is it employment? Is it productivity? How do we measure infrastructure itself? Is it measures of accessibility? Is it measures of expenditure? And how do we deal with things like the spatial autocorrelation and the spatial spillovers? Nice big industry, but I'm not going to go there. We can also look at the alternatives, more sophisticated land use transport interaction models, which pretend to go behind it, or using computable general equilibrium models. And I've been involved in some European projects that have actually put the two alongside one another. Can we get different answers? Or can we get sufficiently similar answers from using CGE models or using LUTI models? And the answer to that is, well, in some circumstances, we can get similar answers out of them, and we can explain some of the differences between them. All of these tend to give us estimates of wider benefits, but the one thing that comes out of them is you need huge changes in accessibility to get very small changes in GDP per capita. Huge changes. You know, it's by a factor of sort of 10 to 1 that the changes in accessibility are required. And yet, in going back and checking these things afterwards, the number of ex post studies where we go back and say, let's take a particular piece of infrastructure and see what effect it really has, are very, very few and far between. They're methodologically quite difficult to do that because of all of the other things that happen. We did a rather sort of back of the envelope study of the impact of the Channel Tunnel on Kent and Nord-Pas-de-Calais, particularly the coastal regions either side, where we wouldn't have I never expected there would be a very big impact, and the answer was that there wasn't a very big impact. You don't see very much going on in those areas, and we predicted that, you know, sort of 20 years previously. 2 weeks ago was the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Canterbury, which empowered the building of the Channel Tunnel. It was the international treaty that did it. And a lot of old lags who'd been involved in things right from the beginning turned up in order to celebrate that event. What's the effect been locally? Not very much. It certainly didn't cause the complete destruction of the Kent countryside as many people thought it would. But all of these ex post studies are really not terribly encouraging that transport has had a huge effect once you start pulling out all of the other effects that might have gone on. So can we do it by looking in more detail at these agglomeration models, by trying to look at what the competition effects are going to be, by trying to get some sort of effect of localization economies and the urbanization economies? And yes, you know, we seem to be able to get that the increasing density of labour markets does give us some sort of positive elasticity. They're not huge. What is interesting, and I'm relying very much on the work that Dan Graham of Imperial has done initially for Crossrail on this, but also for a number of other studies more recently, and two of his PhD students, both of whose PhDs I've had the privilege of examining. So it's rather nice when you can start plagiarising other people's PhDs rather than finding that people's PhDs are plagiarised, like certain German ministers recently. You get these positive elasticities, but particularly big urban areas, much higher effects for services in this. And that's because of the way the linkage effect worked through the labour markets. So, I mean, I guess many of you will be familiar with the work that has done. It's basically about measuring employment, the effective density of employment, the labour market that's accessible to any firm located in a particular area, depending on total employment, and the availability of distance. That effective density measures captures that, and you can then find the way that agglomeration economies are related to it. At the firm level, and this is the good thing about this, that it's done at the level of the individual firm. It's not done using aerial data, but it's using firm data. And I mean, these were the results that Dan got when he was doing the work that fed into Crossrail. And the critical thing here is that the bigger elasticities you get from banking, finance, insurance and business services. It was before the crash, but the banks seem to have managed to have resurrected themselves in terms of their profitability, don't they, since then. So we would expect we would get that sort of productivity. Much more important for an area like London than manufacturing. The next stage on from that is the micro studies. How do people's behaviour change? I started thinking about this when we looked at initially at the effects of the London congestion charge, where the impacts of the London congestion charge were seriously underestimated in terms of the effect it would have on traffic, because we used normal price elasticities, and here was something completely different, and people reacted in a different way to it. We can see from the work that was done on the Jubilee Line impact, for example, at a quite local level, looking at the impact on property prices. And that again, I think, shows that behaviour changed in a way that was different. The one I find actually most compelling, and the only work I know that's been done on this, is work in France, was the effect of the high-speed rail line, which actually led in both in the Paris-Lyon case and the Paris-Lille case to firms not relocating along the line, maintaining a location in both urban areas, but actually internally restructuring what they did. So they used the improved communications, Paris-Lyon coming down from nearly 4 hours to 2 hours, Paris-Lille coming down from over 2 hours to 1 hour as a result of high-speed rail. They could think about the way that they could use this internally within the firm. So you can decide to specialise. You move, for example, your marketing department to one location and your HR department to the other location. You get the scale economies that are associated with those activities, but you've got a presence in both locations. And a lot of business is going backwards and forwards between those locations, and particularly Paris-Lyon, which showed a huge increase above and beyond the forecast traffic, seems to be internally related to those firms themselves. And I think that is important in terms of thinking about the way that this infrastructure is used. Okay, I said I would move towards thinking about implications for appraisal and implications for policy. If you go back to Satcher, we spent a lot of time worrying about what a theoretically correct cost-benefit analysis was. Can we use different types of modelling to get towards that? And what sort of wider benefits would be used beyond the user benefits, beyond the journey time savings, through these effects we've talked about? But actually, when we come down to it, is a typical computable general equilibrium, if that was thought to be the way forward in this, actually doesn't provide you with the amount of evidence that you might need in terms of this. The standard diagram tells us that, you know, you reduce costs and you get additional benefits. The reduction in benefits to existing users, and then the rule of the half applied to the others, assuming nice linear demand curves and a nice constant marginal cost relationship. But suppose price is not equal to marginal cost. Suppose there are externalities, so that the marginal cost you observe is not the social marginal cost. Suppose that there are returns to scale, so that marginal cost is not constant. Suppose that demand is responsive to a things other than a change in price, so that we don't have a fixed trip matrix. Now, at some stage, I tried to redraw that diagram with all of those things happening, and it's not easy. And you very quickly lose sight of what's going on in this. But basically, we're talking about a situation where the marginal cost is upward sloping and social marginal cost is greater than marginal cost. Though, of course, with increasing returns, the marginal cost could possibly slope downwards. Price isn't equal to marginal cost. Demand could be shifting outwards in response to changing opportunities. Marginal cost could be shifting downwards because of agglomeration effects. Not easy to determine what we're actually looking at in terms of that. So we actually need to think about how we would get to what at the bottom of this is called the theoretically optimal CBA, where we get all the direct and indirect responses of all economic agents, relaxing the assumption of perfect competition, imperfections in both goods and factor markets. Wages exceeding the opportunity cost of labour, you get taxation effects, you get external costs and benefits in there. It gets much, much more complicated. And certainly starts going well beyond the sorts of things that are analysed in COBA for these things. So I thought it might be useful just to remind you, and I'm sure you're aware of these, of two case studies. the both UK case studies, and I've used these in giving a version of this talk in other parts of Europe, in order to show how advanced we are in our analytical developments in the UK. Crossrail is an urban project, and this is a nice comparison here. Crossrail is an urban project, belatedly bringing what, you know, Paris and Frankfurt and Munich have had for years and years and years, an RER system. What are the agglomeration benefits that come from that? With an interurban project, the high-speed rail line London to Birmingham, with possible extensions northwards. They're similar in scale, in terms of their costs, a lot. They're different in the sense that the direct user benefits in Crossrail didn't justify it. The direct user benefits for HS2 do justify it, just, though they've been falling rather. What are the wider benefits in that case, given that we've got an interurban situation, given that the more recent work that's been done by Dan Graham, for example, has tended to show that the distance decay in these benefits is pretty sharp, and so that, you know, is there some sort of wider double city agglomeration effect? But with that, have we captured all the impacts? Just to sort of summarise it so that you know, but I'm sure the ones are very familiar to this. Crossrail costs about 16 billion. The transport user benefits are about just under 13 billion, so that you've not got a positive net present value on that. But if you add to that the additions to the conventional appraisal of about 7 billion, it becomes a justifiable project in terms of the agglomeration benefits, in terms of the imperfect competition, and so on. Whether you do it in terms of welfare effects or you do it in terms of the impact on GDP, adding the additional benefits does make it a worthwhile project, and that comes out of this increasing the effective density of the London labour market. If you look at HS2, then in this we've got about a 25 billion project. We've got about 28 and a bit, nearly 29 billion of transport user benefits, most of those being business user savings, which are evaluated somewhat higher. And we've got a relatively small amount of agglomeration benefits and imperfect competition effects, which adds a much smaller amount to it. Now, you can see where the 10% rule doesn't quite work there. The 10% rule, if you added to user benefits there, wouldn't get you home. The 10% added to the user benefits here, in a sense, is not needed. But you can see that this is closer to 10% than it was in the previous case. If you actually look at the effects of that, and this is taken from the original documents that were published something just over a year ago, gives you a benefit cost ratio between 2.4 and 2.7. I think without breaking too many confidences, I can tell you that those benefit cost ratios have come down to somewhere well below 2 now, because basically the transport user benefits were being overestimated because of various sorts of impacts. It's still positive in terms of that. I actually think that there is a potential for greater, wider economic impacts with this, and a little bit of work was done in order to try and see what the effects were. If you add two big cities together, do you get benefits that we're not counting in this traditional increasing density? And that was largely based on, could we transfer the experience that we'd learned from the French case, particularly Paris-Lyon, but also Paris-Lille, and transpose that into a London-Birmingham context. What's interesting with HS2 is that the additional work that's been done on adding the links that go north of Birmingham, I apologise to any Brummies in the audience, but I used the phrase that had been attributed to Lord Palmerston in the 19th century over the building of a Channel Tunnel, when he said he couldn't see why anybody wanted to shorten the distance, it was already too damn short. And I said, I used the same context, and why would anybody want to go to Birmingham? As a Lancastrian, however, I can see why there would be benefits increasing the linkage, though as a West Lancastrian, why on earth anybody would want to go to Manchester, I'm not quite clear. But the benefits do seem to be much greater, as you might expect if you make the network bigger, because it brings more of the country into contact with it. But it's a different dimension of the sorts of benefits that you're getting from the urban context in Crossrail. And it raises a very interesting issue, I think, with this, which is that how do we measure the marginal impacts of marginal additions to a well-developed network? Is building a high-speed rail network in the UK context of a relatively efficient rail network, particularly after the upgrading of the West Coast Main Line, really a marginal change or a very significant change? I've been doing some work with some colleagues in Spain about this, where the high-speed rail network made a huge, huge difference. Not necessarily to the longer distance travel, which it was aimed for, but actually to increasing long-distance commuting into Madrid. And it's had a very major impact on that. So again, it's about the context in which you put these things. But I guess that might be likely to lead to some discussion afterwards. Where's this taken us? Because I was told 45 minutes and we're getting dangerously close to it. I think if you come in within 5 minutes of time, it's about, you know, it's on time, isn't it? The rail rules. Simple rules are dangerous. I mean, that's, I think, the overriding criterion I have in all things related to transport. If you invest in transport, it could seriously damage your health as a region. You get nothing out of it. You could, in fact, lose quite dangerously. The problem is the danger that if you fail to invest in transport, you could also invest to. Politicians like transport. You can point to it and say, look, I built that. And, you know, when I'm being even more cynical than that, I say, and of course, big transport projects get named, you know, roads get named after people, airports get named after people, and so on. And so politicians quite like that. Appraisal rules have got to be comprehensive, and so we go for more and more sophisticated modelling. The trouble is, they've got to be transparent. They've got to be understood by stakeholders. And when the HS2 roadshow goes out to consultation, it's going to find that balance between the complexity of the modelling and the need for it to be understood by stakeholders is got to be very, very important indeed. And the level at which decision making is made on this. The importance of spillovers, very, very important in terms of this, because clearly you don't always get the positive benefits where you suffer the negative disbenefits from a transport. And you can see that with HS2. It goes storming through the Chilterns, which are rather nice, and people in the Chilterns get no access to it. And so you can see that they might get a little bit irate about that. And telling them that the commuter services from Milton Keynes will be better may not be the compensation that they're looking for in terms of that. Policy is often made at the tie level and gets refracted. That's more of a European Union thing. You know, it's all very well to devise trans-European networks when you're requiring them to be built and maintained by the member states and the regions. And that competition between jurisdictions, very important. The spillover effects that you get, which, you know, work in both directions. The work that's been done by people like Marlon Bornet in California, very interesting to see the extent to which investing in improved transport, which means basically roads there in most cases, and the effect it has, it can sometimes be very positive to the region you build the roads in. But in some cases, it can be more positive to the neighbouring municipalities if they're not having to bear some of the cost. And we need to think about those sorts of activities. Okay. We're definitely coming into the station. We've gone through this full circle. We go through, transport is critical. Whoops, beware the double counting effect. We better be rather careful about what we put into this. To an era where wider benefits are the key, particularly in areas where transport is becoming very, very costly and the user benefits don't always stack up. But all the simple rules in transport appraisal have got to be come with a health warning on this. But the nice thing, the positive thing for all of us in this room, I guess, is there's still a lot of research to be done. The relationship between imperfect competition and productivity gains from transport. Do imperfectly competitive industries simply absorb those improvements in transport, rather than transferring them into things that are genuinely wider benefits to the economy at large? Can we do more work on the microbehavioural evidence? What about the difference between link effects, where we've intended increasingly to try and parcel transport improvements up into tiny bits and hope the private sector will pay for them? In whole or in part, whereas the real benefits are felt at the network level. Joining up high-speed rail links across Europe is where the benefits ultimately may be felt, not on the individual links. The spillovers and jurisdictional competition I've made, and genuinely we need to solve the problem of how seriously to do ex-post studies. Can we find whether transport investment has really made the difference? And that raises the interesting question. Over what time period? We did the work 10 years after the opening of the Channel Tunnel on Kent and Nord-Pas-de-Calais, and our argument there was we weren't given long enough. That the real benefits of transport may well occur over a much, much longer period of time. The real benefits in the sense of, if we had not done this, what would have been the constraint on transport over that period? If we'd not built the motorway network in the UK, how would the UK be different? If France had not built its high-speed railway network, in what way would the French economy be different? And that goes back to a very nice old question: what was the impact of the railroads in the opening of the American West? So we go round full circle in these things. There's still an awful lot to be done. And I think it's always nice to feel that you're finishing a lecture saying, we've only just begun. I'll stop there. Thank you.